Hello and welcome to the December IASB Update podcast. My name is Claire Short and I am part of the communications team at the IFRS Foundation. Today I am joined by Andreas Barkov and Sue Lloyd, Chair and Vice Chair of the IASB respectively. And we'll be talking about the topics discussed at the meeting held from the 14th to the 16th of December 2021. This was, of course, the last meeting of the year, and a number of topics from October and November were back on the agenda, including the primary financial statements project and the project on rate regulated activities. So let's dive straight into those. Sue, looking at PFS first, there was much discussion this month around joint ventures and associates. Why was that?
Okay, so that was in the context of a discussion that we were having about what income and expenses would be included in this sort of category that we describe as the investing category, and we decided to still call it the investing category, so outside sort of operating and financing. And so we were talking about whether or not we should specifically require income and expenses from associates and joint ventures to be put into that category. And the reason why it was quite a long discussion was that the board was clear, based on past decisions, that those amounts shouldn't be in the operating section because they're very much a sort of net after-tax figure, so different in nature to other things in the operating section. But the sort of general description of the investing category is income and expenses from assets that generate returns individually and largely independently from other resources held by the entity. And it's not always the case that associates and joint ventures would meet that definition. So that's why it was a long and protracted discussion. And in the end, the board agreed that we should include income and expenses from associates and joint ventures in that category, along with incremental expenses on assets that generate returns individually and largely independently from other resources held by the entity. And rather than setting an objective for the category, because it's now a combination of things with slightly different characteristics, that rather the sort of description of the objective would be included as an explanation and the basis for conclusions on how we ended up with essentially the list of items that's included in that category. We also agreed that income and expenses from individual assets and disposal groups that are classified as held for sale and income and expenses on business combinations wouldn't be classified in the investing category. And we confirmed that negative returns and interest expense should be classified in the same category as positive returns are. And so that was sort of tidying up that investing category. And as I said, the other thing we did was confirm that it would be called investing. The other main topic that we discussed this week on primary financial statements was this definition of unusual income and expense. People watching this project might remember that we had proposed in the exposure draft that there be a disclosure of items that meet the definition, because investors are very interested in understanding this. And the first question that the staff asked us, which on the surface is easy, is does the board want to continue to work on a definition of unusual items of income and expense? And I think the response that we gave, and Andreas and I were both in this camp, was a tentative and cautious yes. We think it's a good thing to work on. Investors are very interested in trying to understand this information, to understand sort of expectations of whether amounts will continue to arise in future periods. But the reason why we're cautious is that while there was a lot of positive feedback about the idea of unusual income and expense, there was also a lot of suggestions provided about what we needed to do to sort of clarify and refine the definition. So it's not an easy thing to define. And so we spent most of the meeting after answering the easy question with a longer discussion about sort of thoughts from board members to give ideas to the staff to move this forward. So you'll see us discussing that sort of proposed improved definition at future board meetings.
Thank you, Sue. Turning to you, Andreas, and to the project on rate regulated activities, this month the board discussed a more detailed plan for taking this piece of work forward. Can you tell our listeners what that plan is about and how the board reacted to it?
Sure. Staff set out their plan for a future discussion of the feedback received from the 2021 exposure draft. You will recall that we discussed the feedback at some length during our two board meetings in October and November. While the proposals were generally perceived favourably by our stakeholders, there are a few areas where concerns were more pronounced, and the staff had organised their plan for leader evaluations along the respective levels of support, if I may call it that way. That has led to three broad buckets: topics that raise significant concerns, and the three areas that feature in that camp are total allowed compensation, scope, and minimum interest rate; topics that were generally well received, encompassing recognition, unit of account and derecognition, measurement, items affecting regulated rates only when cash is paid or received, interactions with other IFRS standards, as well as presentation and disclosure. And the third bucket then consists of other topics such as transition proposals, effective dates, effects analysis and due process steps. Our staff proposed to prioritise total allowed compensation and scope, so two of the areas where concerns were most present, and not to go for low-hanging fruits first. The board agreed with that approach and thought it would be better to tackle the thorniest issues first to avoid potentially ugly surprises later on. We also agreed with the staff's suggestion to use our existing consultative group to help us in these matters.
Thanks, Andreas. Let's turn our attention now to other topics on the agenda this month, starting with FICE, or the Financial Instruments with Characteristics of Equity project. Andreas, can you update us on developments in FICE?
Yep. So this is a follow-up paper on comments we had in the September meeting. The project focuses on compound financial instruments with characteristics of both liabilities and equity. There were three main areas addressing practice issues the board agreed to. The first area was centered around classification of a compound financial instruments with contingent settlement provisions. And the three items that we clarified were, firstly, that some requirements in IAS 32 regarding the order of requirements to be applied to a compound financial instrument. So that's related to paragraph 28 in particular, that has to be applied before all other requirements in IAS 32 kick in. How to measure the liability component of the compound financial instrument. And we decided that this should be the full amount of the condition obligation at the earliest repayment date. And lastly, we decided to clarify that discretionary payments and this dividends paid are allocated to the equity component. The second part and the second main area concern the meanings of the words liquidation and non-genuine that are used in IAS 32. We clarified that liquidation is a process of permanently ceding to trade or operate. And non-genuine is meant to be not only a probability assessment, but really focusing more on the aspect of the situation being abnormal. Then the third area concerned the effect of laws on contractual terms, and the board agreed that the interaction between laws and contractual terms when classifying financial instrument would be as follows. An entity would include those terms that are based on laws and then repeated in the contract if they have been adjusted or made more specific. So essentially such that there is a different outcome to what would have been the case simply as a result of the law being in place. And it would exclude terms in a contract from a classification analysis if their enforceability would be prevented by the operation of law.
Thank you, Andreas. Next up was business combinations under common control. The board heard an overview from feedback received on its recent discussion paper. Sue, can you give us some highlights, please?
Sure. So maybe it's worthwhile just reminding people what this project's about as background. We haven't spoken about it for a little while because it's been out for comment. So this is a set of proposals for how a company that sort of takes control of a sister company would account for that transaction. And the reason why we're addressing this is because, unlike other acquisitions, these types of transactions are specifically scoped out of IFRS 3, and we know that there's diversity in terms of how people account for those transactions. So this discussion paper is all about providing a framework for the accounting for those transactions. And it had proposed that in some circumstances, an acquisition method similar to what you see in IFRS 3 should be applied, and in other cases, a book value method should be applied. So with that short background, what did we hear back? We were just hearing at this meeting the sort of summary of the feedback from the comment letters and the outreach. And the good news was that almost all our respondents agreed with the scope of the project, that it should cover the receiving entities, the acquirer, and my simple examples, reporting for the transaction. Also, most respondents agreed with the proposal that we had in the document that in some cases the acquisition method was appropriate and others a book value method should be applied. Also, almost all users, so investors, agreed that business combinations under common controls that affect non-controlling shareholders of the receiving entity should use the acquisition method, and all other business combinations under common control should use the book value method. That is subject to cost-benefit thinking, but that was the sort of general feedback that we got. Quite a bit of the discussion in the discussion paper was about making a distinction depending upon whether or not the company that takes control of the sister has any non-controlling shareholders. And most respondents agreed that the two exemptions from the requirement to use the acquisition method where there are non-controlling interests in favour of the book value method should not apply to publicly traded companies, so seeing a distinction with private companies. And there was mixed feedback from respondents on whether privately traded companies should be allowed to use some of the exemptions that were proposed in the discussion paper. So a real mix of feedback. And I think, again, the staff got quite a few suggestions from the board on what to think about going forward. And we'll look forward to hearing how the staff responds to some of that in the further analysis of that discussion paper.
So by the sounds of it, that project will be back on the agenda in upcoming months. Let's look at the SMEs project now. Sue, the staff this month presented quite a few papers. Can you take us through some of the key points that were made?
Yes, a lot of papers. So I'll focus on just a few highlights of the discussion. So what the staff has been doing is taking us through a very orderly and structured and very good, I must say, process of looking at a standard by standard basis of how we should assess this idea of areas for alignment between full IFRS and the IFRS for SMEs, with the objective of ultimately publishing an exposure draft with some proposed amendments to the SMEs standard in the second half of next year. So just a few of the things that we discussed this month, we covered a lot. So some highlights were agreement by the board to align the definition of a business with the amended definition of a business that we now have in IFRS 3, to align the definition of control with the definition in IFRS 10, and to update the rebuttable presumption in the SME standard about when control exists to reflect those amendments in IFRS 10. IFRS 11, the joint arrangement standard, we had an interesting discussion where we decided to align the definition of joint control in the SME standard with what we have in IFRS 11, but not to change the subsequent accounting that's set out in the SMEs standard. So that was a bit of a nuanced set of decisions. And I think the last one that I would highlight, and people who know me well would say, well, of course, is the discussion we had on expected credit losses and the extent to which we should align with IFRS 9. Quite a long discussion on that. And what we agreed was to try to come up with a sort of simplified application of expected credit losses to make sure that it's proportionate for the SME population, but making sure that it is as consistent as possible as the outcomes with IFRS 9. And really, I think a bit of a steer from the board that if we can't really get something closer to the principles of expected credit losses, it might be better to think about whether we should just keep things as they are with the accounting for impairments on loans and the SME standards. But the staff's gone away with the objective of getting the ECL approach to work.
So as a reminder on this project, the board and staff are working towards publishing an exposure draft in the second half of 2022. So keep your eyes on that one. Finally, the board heard from the project on creating a narrow scope amendment for a lease liability in a sale and leaseback transaction. Sue, can you describe what that transaction is and why we are addressing it? And then perhaps take us through some highlights from the feedback received.
Sure. So we're dealing with a very particular population of transactions here. So a transaction where, say, a company owns an asset, they sell it to somebody, another entity, and then they lease that same asset back. And so they continue to have the right to use the asset that they previously owned. And we've got some very particular requirements in IFRS 16, which essentially restrict the amount of gain or loss that you can recognize if you undertake one of those transactions, really because you still kept part of the asset because you kept the right to use the asset. And it gets tricky when you have to apply that very specific requirement in IFRS 16 in combination with a lease that's got some variable payments that are, say, linked to turnover that wouldn't usually be included in the lease liability if it was a standalone lease. So that's the tension that we're trying to deal with. And we put out an exposure draft with some proposals to address the subsequent accounting for those types of leases in the sale and leaseback transaction. And this is at this month's meeting, working out what the way ahead is, given the feedback that we got on that exposure draft. So focusing on the key decisions that were made this month, put simply, the board decided to keep the proposals in the exposure draft, which would continue to limit the amount of the gain or loss that's recognised on one of these sale and lease back transactions. And that would be the case even when the lease back includes variable payments that wouldn't usually be included in the measurement of a lease liability in the case of a standalone lease. So confirming that proposal. But the board decided to change some of the specific aspects of what was in the exposure draft, really to cut back on the level of specificity in what was proposed. So the board has decided not to prescribe how the proportion of the old carrying amount of the asset that gets sold relates to the right of use asset that the seller retains, and also not to be too prescriptive about how to measure and account for these lease payments on the leaseback transaction. So what we decided was that the lease payments have to be determined in a way that supports this limitation on the gain recognition that I was talking about, but that the board won't be very prescriptive in terms of setting out how a company is required to determine the lease payments that are included in those calculations. So really trying to balance, you know, doing enough to give people certainty about what to do, but really not overstepping into making too many changes to IFRS 16, particularly in light of the fact that the post-implementation review is still coming up for that standard.
Thank you, Sue. Let's, before we wrap up this very last podcast of 2021, I'd like to come back to you, Andreas, and ask you what your key takeaways were from this year. It's been a very, very busy year. So what were your highlights?
You're right, Claire. It was a busy year. And I would just add, it has been another extraordinary year for both our stakeholders and our organization, and certainly not just because of the pandemic. We saw important consultations this year, such as management commentary, business combinations under common control, and our third agenda consultation that I would spend a little bit on after my next remark, which is, can only be devoted, obviously, to sustainability. This year was probably the most significant in terms of organizational change for the foundation, with the COP26 announcements around the creation of the ISSB, the merging of the VRF and the CDSB into the IFRS Foundation, and the technical recommendations by the Technical Readiness Working Group for the ISSB being the highlights. In this regard, I shall surely not forget to mention yesterday's announcement about the appointment of Emmanuel Faber as the inaugural chair of the ISSB, whom I wholeheartedly congratulate on his appointment and extend my warm welcome to our organization. I'm very much looking forward to working with him and the new sister board. Coming back to the agenda consultation and looking ahead, we have to decide our future agenda for 2022 and 2026, and that will be a very big focus early on in the next year. So this month, we heard the last tranche of the feedback on our agenda consultation being on the impacts, if any, on our existing work program. Some stakeholders said to prioritize the projects on the current work plan, while others said there is a need to reassess those projects, so fairly split, I'd say. Some respondents wanted to pause or discontinue a current project that have made little progress, address an issue that's not seen to be pervasive, or have a lower priority than newer projects. And some respondents have also commented on all other current projects. Over and above I think we have heard a clear message that the board should continue with its current work program. There are a few topics that we will have to rediscuss, but overall, the key message is you're right to continue where you are. Given that almost all respondents also agreed with the criteria for selecting new potential projects, the board finalized the criteria that it will then use to evaluate the projects. The board also responded to concerns and emphasized that no feedback will be disregarded and that all stakeholders, that particularly includes preparers that have been mentioned in the process, and we have taken note of them.
Thank you, Andreas. And that brings us to the end of another IASB Update podcast. It is also my last episode as host, and I must say I am going to miss my monthly conversations with Sue and Andreas and wish them well as they take this podcast forward in the new year. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast on our website, as well as on our YouTube channel and Spotify. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Have a wonderful festive season and remember to tune in next month. Goodbye.